Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. I know most of America and probably most of you watched a couple of weeks ago as Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, that's her official title, I believe, was shocking Oprah Winfrey and all of us when she said she contemplated suicide. Well, there's a profession that I talk about a lot that I feel close to. I'm honored to feel close to veterinary medicine, where this happens all too frequently. And I wanted to talk about it because I don't believe it should just be shoved into a corner, a dark corner somewhere, and never spoken about. I think it's helpful that all of you know this is the case. And maybe when you visit the veterinarian, you can consider what is reality. Dr. Natalie Marks is here to talk about it. It's not an easy subject to talk about, Dr. Marks. I think it's important that clients, pet parents, understand the truth here, though.
I do too, Steve, and I'm really honored and grateful that you have me on and that we're going to talk about this, because I think, as we saw with Meghan Markle, hearing that phrase, you know, I was thinking about doing this to myself, or I asked for help and I didn't get that, is something that still is happening very, very frequently today. And unfortunately, just in the last 3 weeks, 6 veterinary professionals have taken their own life.
Wow.
And it's been very, very hard on the profession to get up in the morning and do what we do, yet knowing that so many of us are struggling with mental and emotional health.
So a good friend of mine back in 2014 took her life. And back in 2014, I admit it, I did these videos to salute her, named Dr. Sophia Yin, a very high-profile veterinarian. And we were friends. We would swap videos. I'd see her presentations, and I'd say, that is the coolest thing in the world. Or she'd say that to me, and I'd say, here's my video. And, you know, we went out to lunch periodically at conferences, that kind of thing. I had no idea. No idea. And when I was informed that this happened, I did a salute video, and I said, well, she passed away. I don't know. I just don't remember how old Dr. Yin was. But she was certainly under 50, I believe. And it's just shocking. But I probably did the wrong thing by not saying, of course, I didn't know what her family wanted at that time either. But still, we need to talk about this and talk about why it's happening so much in veterinary medicine. How much does this happen in veterinary medicine?
Well, Steve, there's a few stats that I think would be helpful for pet parents to understand and general public too. Nearly 400 veterinarians died by suicide between 1979 and 2015. But as we've looked more recently, they found that in 11,000 veterinary death records, that female veterinarians are 3.5 times more likely to kill themselves by comparison to the general population. So 3.5 times more likely. And that's somebody like me, who's a working mom who's doing long hours, answering client emails at 11 o'clock at night or on weekends, having to go through sometimes daily euthanasias with families and dealing with lots of other struggles I'm sure we'll talk about. But it is a huge concern. And I'm so glad you said, you know, I don't know if I did the right thing, because that's really one of the biggest problems here, is that I don't think universally people really know what is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. How do we help veterinarians, and not just veterinarians, but veterinary nurses and technicians and other veterinary professionals that are struggling with similar variables here that are making life pretty hard.
Yeah, I want to talk about why you think it is in this profession. There are other professions, but that's not what this show is about, right? So why is it, do you think, that in the veterinary profession, and I'm so glad you brought up technicians and nurses because they're a part of all of this, why do you think the rate is so high?
Well, I think we have a very unique set of stressors that a lot of people in professional and outside industry careers don't have. So let me just touch on a few of them. One of them is most of us end up starting our profession with tremendous amounts of debt. Going to school, unfortunately, in 2018, the average starting debt for those veterinarians was $76,000 before they had their first day on the job. So there's also still, as there is in many industries, gender gaps in salaries and wages, and other struggles within just getting first jobs. So
I want I'm interrupting you only because I think the people perceive, okay, you start your first job, okay, it's not good. That's a lot of money, $76,000 in debt or so. But you're going to make $300,000 that first year. But that isn't at all the case, is it?
No. I mean, we are not human MDs. We're not dentists, plastic surgeons, other, we'll say, medical professionals that have a much higher starting salary than veterinarians, especially if you are a mixed animal practitioner, a large animal practitioner, practicing in more rural areas where the starting salaries, of course, are not going to be what downtown Chicago might, you know, command. Nonetheless, the debt-to-income ratio is more than 2-to-1. So you have a ton more debt than you're ever making, and you still need to live, right, or support your family. So that's a financial reality that we all have to face when we graduate. So that's a stressor in itself. Then we have to think about the type of people who are veterinarians. Most of us are perfectionists. Most of us are incredibly empathetic and compassionate. Most of us can be high-functioning, anxious people or high-functioning depressives. We have a lot of characteristics that make us basically wear our heart on our sleeve a lot. And most of us also don't have thick skin. So we're starting with stressors. We're those type of people. And then we're dealing with life and death situations with families almost every day.
All right. I want to pick that apart a little bit. So I'll start where you ended there about the life and death situations every day. I don't believe any other medical professional deals with death on a daily basis quite like veterinarians do.
No, it's true. And I think one of the scenarios that I give often just for people to understand is, you know, we often see a puppy at 8, 9, 10 weeks of age all the way through until the day we say goodbye. And that can be, or a kitten, you know, that could be 12 to 20 years sometimes that we're working with that family. So that pet in that family becomes part of our family. And we have very strong emotional bonds to them. So saying goodbye with that family, we're saying goodbye too. And it's very, very hard. We're grieving, but we're trying to be strong for the family. But we might have to go immediately from that euthanasia that we are personally grieving as well and trying to be a rock for the grieving family. And 10 or 15 minutes later, may have to go instantly to a brand new puppy appointment. And suddenly we have to wipe all that grief off of our face and go into an incredibly different emotional scenario with a family who's starting off with, you know, this brand new, bubbly, you know, chubby, clumsy lab puppy. Now, certainly that sounds like a great, you know, kind of escape from the grief.
Sure.
But the problem is we never get to grieve, right? We just keep going.
And even when you're not grieving, and I'll talk about this when we come back, all right, you're not dealing with this once or twice a week, but throughout an entire career, many, many times a day, very often. That's got to take a toll. I want to talk about that and much more. The truth about veterinary medicine, that's what we're talking about when we come back on WGN. Dr. Natalie Marks is here. We're talking about a very difficult topic, but a real one, and that is why suicides are so incredibly prevalent in veterinary medicine. And the question, Dr. Marks, I want to ultimately get to is, all right, I've got a puppy, I've got a kitten, I've got a pet rabbit, guinea pig, whatever it is. What can I do to help my veterinarian to feel better? We'll get to that, but first, we were talking about euthanasia, and the reality is that is a good thing. For not always, but most of the time, overwhelmingly, it is the right thing to do. I would suggest you'd agree with that. But even if you don't have a relationship, and you were talking about the difficulty, if you do with that client that you may have known for 20 years, maybe longer, whatever, and that pet that you might have known from the time that pet was adopted through end of life, even if you don't, dealing with death over, even if it's the right thing to do, over and over and over and over again, and that profound, because of the human-animal bond, that profound grief the family is feeling, I bet it's not an exaggeration to say, and I know I have, to hear screaming and crying because the grief is so profound. You have to deal with all that.
We do. And, you know, there's a couple additional points of that that make it even harder, right? So one thing is that we don't, when I was in school, I didn't get any training on veterinary social work. I didn't get any training on how to counsel these mm-hmm. families. You know, what we now, there is actually a profession of veterinary social work for therapists who come in and help counsel these grieving families. We've had to do this my whole professional career, and that's really hard. You know, we have a lot of different hats we wear during the day, and one of them is being sometimes a therapist, and that's not necessarily our wheelhouse. So that is hard. You mentioned the euthanasia of the pet you don't know. That sometimes is even harder because we don't have a relationship with the human attached to that leash or carrier, and they're grieving, and they may need us, and we don't know how to help them. So that even becomes a more of a weight on us. And then finally, there still happens around the country sometimes economic euthanasias.
Oh, sure.
Which is when...
Explain what that is.
Yeah. So that, you know, and that is to me the hardest situation to go through, because that's when a family has to make this incredibly difficult choice that we cannot afford to care for this my dog or my cat's chronic disease or cancer or whatever they're trying to deal with. And we have no other option.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that brings up a topic I was just going to bring up. I believe veterinarians are held to a different standard. I mean, the answer to that would be, from some people, you wouldn't euthanize my pet if you cared about my pet. You would somehow find the money to back this to pay for whatever treatment it is, which means you don't care. Yet, I don't think we say that to doctors. I don't think we say that to dentists or ophthalmologists. Why do we say that to veterinarians?
Yes, I wish I knew, Steve. Yeah, I really do, because I've heard that many, many, many times over in the last 20 years of practice. And I know it's not coming from a malicious place most of the time. You know, it's out of grief or shock or, you know, this traumatic interaction, and people are desperate, right? They just want an answer and are crying out for help. The thing that I think clients don't understand or realize is, you know, I was a practice owner. I had, you know, 60 employees depending on me to help guide that practice, so they had wages and they could feed their families and they could have insurance and other things about that. The other thing is that I think if more pet parents understood the benefits of pet health insurance, because there are so many, that the cost of veterinary care, which is rising every year, would not be such a shock or an obstacle to them having a pet in their home for as long as they want that. Because when you go to your physician, it's really uncommon for them to say, well, here's your itemized bill, and you need to pay for this at the time of service, right? Most people never even see their bill. They just have to send their insurance or their copay and move on. But there's such a, you know, only 2% of pet parents in the U.S. right now, 2 to 4%, I think, have pet health insurance.
Right.
And so it's such a small percentage that they really don't understand the value of what that allows you to do when you really want to provide the best care for your pet and work well with your veterinarian.
All right. So what can people do? There's much more to talk about. Believe it or not, there are other reasons for all this that we're just not going to have time to really discuss. I mean, that's how complex I think this issue is. And there are organizations that are trying to help veterinarians, and veterinary schools are now trying to help students even before they become veterinarians. But how can clients help?
I can think of two ways off the top of my head. So one is when you are scheduling an appointment to see your veterinarian, to come prepared. Come prepared with questions. Call ahead and say, hey, what do I need for this exam? You know, with the changes COVID has produced with curbside and, you know, telehealth and things like that, the most common complaint we hear from clients is, well, I forgot to ask this during my appointment, and now my vet's with another client. Now I'm frustrated. And then they say something mean. If we can be prepared for that time together, then we can make the most of that time and really be efficient and effective in getting all of your questions answered. I know things, you're not going to remember everything every time.
Sure.
But coming with appropriate questions and, you know, your stool sample and making sure that you fast if needed be, so that we can be really efficient. The other thing, though, is on the flip side, is a lot of veterinarians are really struggling with what we call sort of like that couch cheerleader or the couch commentator, which is a person who can't call us directly if they have a constructive piece of feedback or a legitimate concern about service or quality of care or anything like that, but instead post typically a very directed and sometimes personal attack on the veterinarian or the veterinary hospital. And what they don't realize is those reviews are incredibly impactful in a negative way on the veterinary team. And some of the people who have been in this unfortunate category of severe mental health needs or have committed suicide, we know that Google reviews or Yelp reviews or some of the online commentary has been part of that process.
So if you have a complaint, you're suggesting that, and it might be valid.
Yep.
You know, oftentimes I'd argue it's just a miscommunication or misunderstanding, but no matter.
Still valid.
Yeah. Yep. Talk to people. Do it the old-fashioned way.
Or instead of writing something always negative, it's such a wonderful way to reinforce the good work that we do every day to write something positive. You know, write a quick little review of how your first visit was, even though it was curbside, we had a great visit with a veterinarian and my puppy came out happy. Or I didn't realize that your clinic is now doing low stress handling for cats and that made such a huge difference on my cat feeling better when he or she got home. We don't hear enough positive. Now, I will tell you, in my 20 years of practice, I've had the best clients. I mean, I get a lot of positive feedback. I've been very lucky in that. I don't know if that's happening across the board. Certainly when I talk to colleagues all over the country and around the world, actually, as of late, I think because everybody's dealing with their own stresses with the pandemic, sure. We aren't seeing as much positive. We're seeing a lot of struggling people.
Well, so our friend, our mutual friend, Dr. Shelley Rubin, once said this, he says it a lot, and he's right. Veterinarians are our pet's second best friend. And I'm so grateful for what the profession does all the time and for what you've done, Dr. Marks, and your colleagues. And that includes technicians and nurses who are radically underpaid for what they do, which is a whole different topic we don't have time for. Dr. Marks, thank you for talking about what is a very tough topic to talk about.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for featuring this.
So what are the most common dog breeds in Chicago? So last week I talked about the most common dog breeds, according to the American Kennel Club, registration numbers all over the country. And number one for 30 years, the Labrador Retriever. Before that, what do you think, which breed do you think was number one? The Beagle was number one, Snoopy. But right now in Chicago, what do you think the most popular breeds are? So walking up and down the streets in Chicago, think in your head, what dogs am I seeing most often? Well, number five on the list, Bulldogs. Number four, German Shepherd Dogs. Number three are the Labrador Retrievers. So they're number one in America, but number three, number three in Chicago. Number two, the Golden Retrievers, and the most popular breed in Chicago, in the Windy City, the city of broad shoulders. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba! It is the French Bulldog. Gosh, they have become so incredibly trendy. You can't read a fashion magazine. Not that I read fashion magazines. I kind of don't. But if you did, or if I did, I mean, they're everywhere in these magazines, French Bulldogs. I don't know what it is about Frenchies. They can be wonderful dogs, for sure. They're dogs with a sense of humor. It's as though they have jokes and they want to tell us their jokes. They are fun dogs. They also snort. And how do I say this correctly? Flatulence, I think that's an appropriate word to say. They do that, and they snore. But they're exciting dogs to have, and they're expensive, potentially. Still, French Bulldogs, most popular dog in Chicago. What about cats up a tree? These stories are popping up all over America, where fire departments are responding to cats in trees. The reality, though, is if you call the fire department. Now, if you live in Mayberry and call Sarah the operator, likely she'll get Sheriff Barney Fife to rescue that cat. But in the real world, no, fire departments generally don't do that, although a few in the news have been doing that, which is wonderful. You know, my answer to that First off, keep your cat indoors if that's possible. But if the cat is up in a tree, tuna, salmon, sardines, put one thing like that at the base of the tree, wait for the cat to come down. Usually patience and the cats overcome fear with hunger. And I will tell you, don't go up into that tree to try to rescue the cat. Don't do that. Hospitals report more people being injured from trying to rescue a cat than cats that have fallen out of trees. We'll talk to you next week on Steve Dale's Pet World, where I am always out of my tree.